Revolutions Per Minute is a weekly radio show from the New York City chapter of the Democratic Socialists of America. Recorded live at WBAI 99.5 in Brooklyn every Wednesday at 9 p.m. RPM is about doing the work to build a democratic socialist future. Each week, hear the latest news, analysis, and organizing experience from the minds and hearts of activists fighting every day in New York City. Join the movement at socialists.nyc.
You're listening to Revolutions Per Minute, live from the new WBAI Studios, a socialist radio show, and podcasts from members of New York City's Democratic Socialists of America. The Democratic Socialists of America is the largest socialist organization in the United States, with 90,000 members nationwide, and New York City DSA is its biggest chapter. We are run by our 7,000 members and organizers who are working together to build democratic socialism in all five boroughs. My name is Desiree Joy Frias. I use she, her pronouns, and I'm on the organizing committee of the Bronx Upper Manhattan branch. Because of my access to birth control and abortion, I was able to have my first child last year, when my husband and I were financially stable enough, emotionally ready, and could be the best parents we could be for him. Family planning is a human right for all birthing bodies, and after experiencing childbirth, I'm an even stronger advocate for everyone's right to an abortion, on demand, for any reason they decide to. For too long, anti-abortion forces have claimed the label of pro-life, while passing laws and encouraging actions that cause direct harm to people's lives and bodies. As the right-wing assault on abortion access in the United States continues to escalate, organizers in New York City are fighting back and standing up for politics that center bodily autonomy, human rights, and reproductive freedom. On tonight's show, we're live with Yusuf and Katie from New York City for Abortion Rights on the local struggle to defend abortion clinics and how you can get involved. Plus, we visit with the New York City Taxi Workers Alliance sit-in at City Hall, which is still going on, to discuss another life or death issue, medallion debt forgiveness. Taxi workers are demanding that New York City provide adequate debt relief for drivers as soon as possible. We'll hear from Augustine, a worker organizer, on why New Yorkers need to stand up for taxi workers. But first, the headlines with Bernard Goiter.
In local news, Governor Hochul had New York State's parole board release 191 inmates from Rikers Island after signing Assemblymember Farrah Saffron-Forrest's Less is More bill, which limits the kind of small violations of parole that can return a parolee to prison. Assembly members Emily Gallagher and Zohra Mamdani and State Senators Julia Salazar and Jabari Brisport were among the elected officials who visited Rikers last week, witnessing a humanitarian crisis of abuse and neglect. A New York Times editorial had joined those officials in urging Hochul to sign the Less Is More Act into law. The Legal Aid Society filed two petitions in a court in Queens on Thursday, alleging that the city's Department of Corrections is refusing to disclose how it ensures the safety of Rikers Island inmates during heat waves. The filing came one day after the City Council held an emergency hearing on the deteriorating conditions at Rikers. A driver fatally hit a baby in a stroller and injured two pedestrians in Clinton Hill last Saturday after being chased by the police for driving erratically. Transportation Alternatives says that the total number of people killed in traffic accidents in 2021 is now 188, about 30% over last year and on pace to be the deadliest year since Mayor Bill de Blasio took office with his Vision Zero plan to bring traffic deaths to zero by 2024. The long-awaited Brooklyn Bridge bike lane opened on Tuesday. The two-way lane is protected from cars and pedestrians, but just 8 feet wide, which has sparked critiques from cyclists and activists. The city has delayed giving some students subsidized MetroCards to commute to and from school, resulting in city officials instructing students to jump turnstiles. Although schools have issued these students official notes to allow this, many are worried that law enforcement may attempt to intervene and endanger students. A recent Labour report found that the city has regained less than 50% of the jobs lost during the pandemic. However, public sector unions were able to protect their members, who are disproportionately women, from job losses. Two appellate courts have overturned a judge's previous decision to allow Byron Brown on the ballot for the general election in Buffalo's mayoral race. Brown was defeated in the Democratic primary by DSA-endorsed India Walton,
he will not appear on the general ballot. In other elections news, the City Council Speaker race is shaping up, with Keith Powers in District 4 Midtown East, Carlina Rivera in District 2 The East Village, Justin Brennan, District 43 Bay Ridge, Francisco Moya, District 21 Corona, and Adrian Adams, District 32 Jamaica, each jockeying for the support of Eric Adams, Democratic Party leadership, and other power brokers in the city. The New York State's legislature's Democratic supermajority is likely to renege on the state's 2014 law establishing nonpartisan redistricting, and instead gerrymander the state to secure new Democratic congressional seats. Joel Brooks, a union organizer running for Jersey City Council, told Jacobin he is likely to become New Jersey's first Democratic Socialist elected official in a century if he wins his race this November. Brooks said that DSA volunteers have been the spine, the arms, the legs, the brain, the heart, and the guts of his campaign.
Our headlines are brought to you by The Thorn, an incredible weekly newsletter by New York City DSA Electoral Working Group, covering local politics and radical activism. You can subscribe at thethorn.nyc. So first I want to introduce our guests, Yusuf and Katie. Please introduce yourselves and talk a little bit about what brought you into abortion access organizing.
Hi, I'm Katie Finnegan. I use she, her pronouns, and I'm an organizer with New York City for Abortion Rights, and I'm also involved with the DSA Socialist Feminist Working Group. And I'm involved with abortion rights because abortion is a human right. It's a critical part of our collective liberation. And I have a lot of family members who have very large families that they were not able to decide to really have or have autonomy over their own bodies. And I felt that sort of generational trauma and feel really motivated to end it and not continue that for myself and everybody else.
And Yusuf, how about you?
Hi, I'm Yusuf. They, them, he, him pronouns, and also a member of the DSA and New York City for Abortion Rights and Tempest. Katie said it perfectly. And then I also think it's like an anti-fascist issue, and we have to treat it like that. The far right has been mobilizing for years around this issue and slowly eroding these rights. And particularly I got radicalized in St. Paul, or like around this issue in St. Paul. I used to deliver to a Planned Parenthood clinic, and it was like a fortress. They had gates on the outside and two security checkpoints. And I would go with my like Jimmy John sign, you know, pretty obviously like delivering sandwiches or whatever. And people would like knock on my windows, call me a murderer and all sorts of other stuff. And I was, you know, like, I just can't imagine what the patients had to deal with and getting basic rights to healthcare. So, yeah, that's why I'm here.
Great. And I just wanted, obviously where Roe v. Wade is being challenged at the Supreme Court level, but we do feel, I guess right now in the landscape, that abortion access is relatively safe here in New York City. So what is New York City for Abortion Rights working on now?
Yeah, so we started a few years ago. Right now we're focusing on the clinic in Burnham Hill. We're trying to get the church, St. Paul's Church, to stop hosting this congregation called Witness for Life. They initially were doing once a month protests in Manhattan, and now they've spread to 4 of the 5 boroughs. And so our goal is to prevent them from getting to the clinic, ideally stopping them from being hosted by the church at all. So what we do is we try and stop, physically block their procession and slow them down so that way people can access healthcare, can access the clinic without any interference. And we're also petitioning the church to try and get and doing tablings in the community to try and get them to stop hosting the congregation.
So then there are still these kinds of, you know, what we really associate in the South where it's more challenged. There are still these protests outside of clinics targeting patients then.
Yeah, like I said, it was used to be once a month, but now the Catholic Church has expanded to weekly protests. So they're doing this every week and bringing in people from out of town. And more than that, last year, an evangelist organization, Love Life, established a presence themselves and do a 40 weeks for life, which is, you know, a lot longer than 40 days. But yeah, they also do weekly protests in Manhattan. So I think it's really important to, like, I think people aren't aware that this is happening in every borough in the city. And I think it's really important to raise awareness around that because it's appalling. Like, I don't know how New York should be really, really pissed about it and prevent these people from harassing people.
So we'll talk more.
Katie wants to add.
Yeah, Katie?
Nope, Yusuf said it all.
So we'll talk more about clinic defense and abortion access in a bit. But first, let's talk about another ongoing fight in New York City, the fight for taxi workers to get relief from medallion debt. So my father migrated from the Dominican Republic in 1992. He spoke no English when he moved into the Bronx and became a driver for high class on Fordham Road. He bought one tailored black suit at the Herald Square Macy's and spent 20 years driving. When he picked me up as a kid on Sundays, I felt like a princess in a chariot. Little did I know the extra hours he drove the other days to make up for our time together. Every year it became harder to make ends meet, and he started working longer and longer hours. The hours behind the wheel were hard on his body, and I feel they contributed to his prostate cancer, which he couldn't get treatment for because he had no insurance. By the end, there was no money left in savings, no retirement other than his monthly Social Security checks. His cancer made it too painful for him to drive, so to stay afloat, he still works as a janitor at over 80 years old. Taxi medallions used to be the ticket to the middle class. Their value peaked in 2013 at $1 million. By 2018, they were worth $200,000, and now way less. Drivers are trapped in debt, some for over $500,000 for a license that's continuing to tank in value. Uber and Lyft destroyed the yellow cab industry, but then came 18 months of lost wages due to COVID. 9 drivers have taken their own lives, and countless others have started bankruptcy proceedings, losing their homes, their cars, and garnishing their wages for the rest of their careers. Neither the de Blasio administration nor the federal government have supported these essential workers in their fight against these predatory lenders. I visited their encampment outside of City Hall, which is still going on, to talk to Augustine, a member of the Taxi Workers Alliance, about their demands. Let's hear from him in this clip.
So I'll go ahead and start. My name is Desiree Joy Frias. I use she, her pronouns, and I'm here with Augustine. Augie?
Hi, my name is Augustine Tang. I use he, him pronouns. And I am 37 years old and owner-driver of a medallion taxi in New York City.
How long have you been driving cabs?
For 5 years.
Great. And how did you get started in the industry?
Well, my father passed away 6 years ago and ended up having taken care of his mom, my grandmother, but he also left me behind with his medallion. I had to get lawyers to get it back. I found out that he owed about $530,000 on that loan. I decided to take it, you know, learn a new industry while being able to provide for my grandmother as well too. I made that choice because I remember my father was very proud of owning a piece in New York. It was just a lasting legacy, and after he passed, I just felt it was right for me to take it over.
And what did that medallion mean to your father and your family?
I mean, it was our road to the middle class, right? My father never really said much things about taxis, but he really told me about medallions being something that he cherished and that it will help us in the future. Unfortunately, with the medallion crisis happening right now, I have met somebody. When I first started taxi, I met somebody named Kenny Chow at a taxi stand that taught me some of the taxi 101. He ended up also being a medallion owner that has a $700,000 loan. I, you know, got to meet him. He was just the nicest guy. It was unfortunate that he was one of the 9 drivers that committed suicide. He ended up feeling that was the right choice to do, and it's heartbreaking to hear. So I started becoming really involved. New York Taxi Workers Alliance, and all the great work that they do, showing us and leading us, saying that it's, you know, it's not our fault. It's negligence from the city.
And tell our listeners what my father was a cab driver for 20 years with High Class. Tell listeners, what is that life like? What is it like working taxi?
It's not easy. I mean, with the influx of cars in the city, especially, and all the trucks, the construction, it's difficult to get around. Kind of have to learn the skill of being patient, which is very hard when people are honking at you once the light turns green, or just cutting you off just because you're a taxi driver. We have the stigma of being rude and reckless drivers, and you know, I'm not saying that's not right. I'm not one of them. But, you know, a lot of these owner drivers are very careful with their vehicles. They take care, they keep it clean. They're very safe. This is their business that they thought they were buying into. But the city, you know, allowed them to do it, which really undercut the driver. And they ended up just having this lifelong debt over their head.
Yeah, and, you know, before we get into the government's negligence, how has the rideshare app influx impacted your business and destabilized that medallion? I mean, in the past, people could pay it off, right?
Right. Well, I want to start by saying that the government purposely inflated prices of the medallion to... And they banked $855 million off of these sales of the medallions through fees. And the same officials that allowed Uber and Lyft in and causing all this inflation of the medallion went on to work for Uber and Lyft. That's pretty much the tale of just deep corruption. We have been trying to force the city's hand to do right by us. There have been 9 driver suicides in this process. We have been out here on the street many, many times. We've driven down to D.C. and to Virginia to talk to Congress about the actual predatory lending that was happening within this industry. A lot of these guys who are of 65, 70, 75, some even 80, have lost their retirement. They're in the process of losing their homes and their jobs as well, too.
And tell our listeners, what does this group look like? As you said, you know, the medallion was a ticket to the middle class in the 90s. You know, my father was able to make a living off of cab driving. What does it look like now? What do these drivers have to face?
Well, it's tough when there's so much traffic on the road, right? And so much unfair competition that's been brought onto the street. You know, we've learned to adjust, but there's only so much one person can drive. This industry, driving, it just takes a lot of time, right? You put in the hours in order to make the money. And unfortunately, it's when it's harder for you to go to point A to point B, in search of your, either with a fare or in search of your next fare, then it's just gonna be less income.
And so what we've talked a little bit about the lobbying, the revolving door of lobbying, where the same elected officials that allowed in Uber and Lyft are now working on their corporate boards. What is some of the other corruption and negligence from the government that you're protesting against?
Well, so my union, the New York City Taxi Workers Alliance, have came up with a proposal that will actually save lives. You know, we're asking for the city to act as a backstop, which is the burden of those loans will be on the city and not on the drivers, risking of losing their home, risking of their credit score being drained because of bankruptcy, and also even wage garnishments, right? So for us, we came up with a proposal that would probably cost just a little bit more, most likely cost a little bit more, about $90 million over the span of 20 years, while the city comes up with this insufficient $65 million plan that is a handout to the lenders. For a lot of us, we don't understand why the city is approaching it this way. We believe that the lenders, they're willing to bring down the loan to $175,000. With the city's plan to add on to the backstop, we could have it at everyone at $145,000, and that becomes livable. With the city's plan, unfortunately, they have actually made the criteria worse than what the lenders have been offering us. So the Marble Gate, who has the most loans in the industry as of now, was offering us $275,000. But with the city's plan, they're talking about the range of $330,000. And because of, depending on how much they drop down, if they drop down 40%, they could charge drivers up into $2,000 a month. With our plan, the maximum we could charge is $800 a month. And that's what we think is livable. These guys, we've worked 10, 12, 14-hour days, even longer, in order to make $7 an hour under the city's plan. It's incredibly selfish, and just don't understand why they think that this is the way to go.
And it's dangerous, because not only are we losing lives to suicide because of capitalism and the forces of, you know, of income, but if you're making that little, you're going to push yourself to work hours where you're unsafe, where you're operating a vehicle unsafely just because you have to make ends meet, if that's how much the lenders are taking.
Yeah, absolutely.
And what has been the response when you went down to Congress, when you've reached out to Mayor de Blasio's administration? What is their response?
Well, I just want to thank the elected officials have been supporting us. You know, we have Senator Schumer that has given us their blessing of Taxi Workers Alliance's proposal. We have Richie Torres's. A lot of elected officials have come forward, over 100 elected officials and organizations total have agreed that our plan is the way to go to save lives, and it does right by the drivers. With us, we want to thank organizations like DSA, you know, the Democratic Socialists of America, has been just amazing with their debt and finance. And for us, we're camping out here 24/7 for at least 9 days for the 9 drivers that have committed suicide.
Well, thank you so much for speaking to us, and we're stand in solidarity in your struggle. It doesn't have to be this way, and we hope that they hear you.
It really doesn't. It's really not much more than we're asking for, and it's completely doable. Our plan has been vetted by the comptroller, has been vetted by the Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer, and we're just wondering why would they choose a path to enrich the banks and lenders and kill the drivers when these drivers have committed 20, 30, 40, 50 years of their lives.
Serving the city, serving New Yorkers. You know, you all are essential workers. Y'all keep us moving, and we need to just give you what you're owed.
Yeah, it's really cool that the city has us coming out here 24/7. The longer we have, these guys are pushing 70, 80 years old. How long can we stay out here for? We just have to. It's unfair, but we have to do it.
Well, let's hope victory comes soon. Thank you so much, Augie, for speaking to me. I appreciate it.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
You just heard from Augustine of the Taxi Workers Alliance on the taxi workers' struggle for medallion debt forgiveness. There are drivers camped out at City Hall 24 hours a day for the foreseeable future, and I'll be joining them Friday night at 6 to follow up and see what the response has been. My name's Desiree Joy Frias. You're listening to Revolutions Per Minute on listener sponsor WBAI in New York City, broadcasting at 99.5 FM and streaming on your favorite podcast app. Today, we're talking about abortion access. But first, fundraising pitch. To keep this kind of talk on the radio that is so controversial, so, you know, hot button in this country, we have to continue to support public radio. You have to continue to invest monetarily into WBAI to make sure that our stories and our opinions can stay on the air. So if you make a donation now, we still have some of those union-made Bernie shirts available as thank yous at this. If you give at the $65 level in the name of Revolutions Per Minute. So to give to the station, please call 212-209-2950. Again, that phone number is 212-209-2950. $65 for that Bernie Sanders limited edition, no more printed shirt. Or you can go to WBAI.org. Thank you. So back to Katie and Yusuf from New York for Abortion Access, talking about abortion access. So we talked about why you both support the right to abortion. Let's talk a little bit about this framework of pro-choice and pro-life, terms that people are using broadly to categorize their beliefs. Can you talk about why abortion access organizers don't use these terms? And Katie, if you want to start.
Yes, I will start. Thank you. And thanks for that great reporting, Desiree. So, but on, you know, the pro-life, pro-choice framework that we don't support, we're pro-abortion and like to center that, like abortion. We need to say the unsaid thing. We need to bring it out of the shadows. It's happening. People are getting it everywhere. We shouldn't be afraid to say it as a movement. And I don't think it hurts us to. I think it's worse to not say it. And secondly, I think the pro-life side, right, which is anti-abortion, suggests that the counter, that abortion is counter to life, that, you know, maybe people who get abortions aren't also human living people, but they are. There is no debate about that. And I think we need to be, we can't cede life, the whole notion of that, to anti-abortion folks. And we also know that these folks don't support things like Medicare for all, racial justice, income redistribution, things that we know would actually improve the quality of life of all of us. And that's just something that we know is a pro-life idea. That is a set of pro-life ideas that I'm around. But being anti-abortion is not pro-life.
And Yusuf, what are your thoughts on this framework?
I think Katie hit the nail on the head. Like, I think it's an issue of reproductive justice and not just the choice of, like, whether or not you're going to, you know, if you, whether or not you're going to have a baby, but also, like, if you want to have a baby, you should be able to. And we need to provide, like, create a society where people feel supported in doing that and have the options to do that and are able to control their life. And, you know, it's an issue of bodily autonomy, and having access to healthcare is, you know, kind of essential to making decisions about your life. Like, people die if they don't, sometimes, if they don't get abortions. And I don't know, frankly, I wouldn't be alive if my mom didn't have some abortions. So what's there to say? Like, if you're really pro-life, then respect that.
Yeah, and I want to touch on something that Katie mentioned, which is that a lot of pro-life organizers are not also fighting for the laws and spending from the government that guarantees the extension of life of people who already exist. You know, I'm a Christian and I attend church on Sundays and I'm very active in my church. Luckily, a church that is very about bodily autonomy. But I think it's very hard when I see people in the church, you know, try to justify, you know, their beliefs of being pro-life as biblically based, whereas the word abortion is not in the Bible. And more importantly, you know, Jesus, you know, as a historical figure, was constantly around sex workers, the sick, the elderly people, and trying to extend their lives. And I think that pro-life organizers who don't also fight for Medicare for all, who don't also fight for migrants having a right to live in this country, are not being true to their beliefs. But that's my opinion. So moving on to Texas, I'm sure, Katie, you want to talk a little bit about SB 8 in Texas and how that's kind of changing the landscape of abortion access in our country.
Yeah, so for anyone who isn't aware of this, absolutely a draconian law in Texas that has been passed and is in effect, anybody who knows that an abortion happened or thinks that one did can sue an abortion provider, anybody involved in assisting a patient to receive an abortion before 6 weeks when most people aren't aware that they're pregnant. This is not based in any kind of scientific reasoning. Again, there are no like medical doctors involved in these thresholds of when there is a heartbeat or anything like that. But beyond that, it's deputizing private citizens to act as patrols or legal sort of entities to restrict abortion access. And this law was very intentionally written to be very complicated, extremely hard to adjudicate, and to, because right, the state isn't enforcing this law, the private citizens are, and it's just not a law written in good faith. But this has just changed, you know, I think it brings up how important it is to change not just the opinions of legislators or the Supreme Court, but like people around us that we need to be in our communities advocating for abortion, saying out loud, I had an abortion, I support it. And again, not leaning into this pro-life, pro-choice framework and hiding that like so much of the sort of liberal nonprofit sector has had to do.
And the first doctor has already, come out as having said that he provided an abortion for someone who I believe was 8 weeks pregnant. And people across the country have already started to sue the doctor under this law in hopes of collecting this $10,000 bounty. Yusuf, what do you think that this law and the bounty system do to people who are looking to access abortion? Do you think it has a chilling effect on them looking to access healthcare?
Absolutely. And I think that's a big part of the reason why it's an anti-fascist fight as well. And frankly, a fight against the prison system and et cetera. Like, it's insane to me that that Texas, like, during the winter, they had that cold front. And as a result, so many people didn't have power for days and people died. Like, a lot of people died. And Texas can't afford to invest in their energy infrastructure. But at the same time, they are willing to give people $10,000. Like, they have money for that shit, that stuff, excuse me, somehow are able to do that. And yeah, regarding the church, speaking to your point, Desiree, earlier about the hypocrisy of the church, like, the Witness for Life congregation here in New York City is actually led by someone who has two cases of pedophilia against him. And more than that, he's been put in charge by the Pope to investigate pedophilia in New York City, inside of the Catholic Church. Like, it's insane that these people are like that. And during the, he was a huge advocate for not putting during the pandemic, not putting limits on, how many people can congregate in a single place. Like, these people are willing to let people die if it's under the conditions that they think that are right. And more than that, I could, to add to it, in relation to the NYPD, the church is a huge property owner in New York City. And as a result, they have a very strong relationship with the police. So it's like, at our actions, they don't need to get a permit or whatever, but they still are able to bring a huge police presence out. And for example, last month at our last action, two of our comrades were arrested simply for walking down the sidewalk. Like, it's insane. Totally legal behavior. They sent out the strategic response group, and I don't know, there were probably like 80 cops compared to our like 25, 30 people. Somehow the church has all these resources to do this stuff, but has a total disinterest and fly people around the country to break into clinics. I could go on and on, but doesn't have the money to like actually care for people and like help people have options in their lives.
And Katie, there's this you know, perception around people who choose to get abortions. Can you kind of talk about what the social image is of a person who gets an abortion and what the reality is?
Yeah, I think there's a lot of, I think the person who gets an abortion is something that's evolved over time and sort of differs depending on who you're talking to. I think a lot of people imagine it's lower income folks, people of color, who are engaging in risky sexual behaviors and they need to stop doing that and we need to somehow intervene in that way. I think what we do know is that the more abortion gets limited, the more that rich, white, heterosexual women are going to be able to access that care instead of lower income folks or, you know, non-binary folks, people who do not fit one's image of the person who gets an abortion. And I think really everybody gets an abortion. And that's something we also need to sort of be promoting. Like Uma Thurman wrote in the Washington Post that I didn't know she had an abortion and it was her like greatest shame, but like, Uma, that's cool. That's great. I'm glad you did it. And I think we just need to all really shout out that we had them and that anybody can get it, but we also need to make sure that everybody has the access to, and that's something that is just really being chipped away seemingly every year, every month.
And Yusuf, if you can just touch briefly on abortion as healthcare. I think that people really like make it always seem like, oh, this was a choice to end a pregnancy because I didn't want it. Is that always the case, or are there other cases where abortion is a healthcare decision between a woman and her doctor, or a birthing person and their doctor?
Yeah, it's definitely more complicated than that. Like, the vast majority of people who get abortions are moms themselves. They, like, already have children, you know? And that's the whole part of family planning and being able to, like, choose how you reproduce in the world. So, yeah, it's way more complicated than that. And, again, like I mentioned, abortion saves lives. People die if they don't get abortions sometimes because of complications with their pregnancy. And so it's important to emphasize that it's not just about, you know, yeah, sure, I think people, who, if they just want to have sex, like, as much as possible or whatever, and, like, I'm pro that. That's great. And, yeah, get an abortion. But it's kind of insane. Like, even with the Plan C pills that exist now, we, for some reason, we treat abortion like this thing that has to be safe and rare. And the liberal left especially is, I don't know, complicit in this language. And it's led to the erosion of abortion rights and to the situation that we find ourselves in now, when really we don't need to have these complicated procedures. It should just be over the counter. A person can make a decision about what they want to do with their life.
I agree, Yusuf. And, you know, what they're restricting in Texas is safe abortion. People have been getting abortion since biblical times, since the beginning of recorded history, in various ways, from natural medicine all the way to now. But the difference is that it wasn't safe. You didn't survive. And I think prioritizing living people having safe access to abortion so that they don't make health decisions that could endanger their lives out of necessity should be a priority for people who are allegedly pro-life. But we're going to take questions, which I'm sure a lot of you have, for our two organizers, Dr. Katie Finnegan and Yusuf from New York Abortion Access. So we're going to take questions. We would like you to call in at 212-209-2877. Again, that phone number is 212-209-2877 to hear about your thoughts on abortion access or answer any questions that you have about abortion. Because, you know, if you've never had one, or you don't have a birthing body, a body that is capable of getting pregnant, maybe, you know, some of your opinions stem from misunderstandings about what it looks like actually, what's interesting is for a very long period, first, I think it's about 7, 8, 9 weeks, abortion is actually just a pill. You just take a pill and swallow it, and the body will naturally use that abortifacient. Isn't that right, Katie?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I think, I mean, unfortunately, for me, I think most of the pro-life camp, or at least a lot of literature that I've read, any kind of contraception is considered an abortification or a form of abortion. So there's no alternatives that we're being given except, I think, to not have sex or all to get married and be in heterosexual relationships and continue to support the patriarchy and capitalism. So, yeah, no, the sort of, and of course, in Texas today, just today, a law was signed that restricts access to abortion pills. I think that's something we definitely need to all sort of collectively promote as potentially, you know, we're still going to be fighting for, you know, Roe v. Wade and the right for safe, legal, and free abortion on demand. But we also need to share knowledge with each other about what other kinds of you know, services we can do in our own homes that are relatively safe and have, you know, there's some research done about them or done in other countries.
And again, I'm going to repeat that phone number so you can call in 212-209-2877. Again, that number is 212-209-2877, talking about abortion access here in New York City and across the country. So Yusuf, you know, as an organizer, we all have work, life, a million things that are on our time. So what brings you back every week to spend, you know, hours of your free time, your precious free time, organizing around abortion access?
Well, when I can't, like, thank the comrades in New York City for abortion rights enough, like, the actions that we do are beautiful. They're incredibly militant and so important to building the left. And like, it's such an intersectional issue. Like, Katie mentioned the courts and Roe v. Wade, but it's not just that. Like, that's not enough to protect us. We can't rely on the courts. We can't rely on Congress. We need actual people and our communities to trust and defend each other and support each other. And so that's been the biggest reason. And lately with the tabling that we've been doing, in Burham Hill, it's been incredibly responsive. Like, so many people come and they tell us their stories about abortion. They tell us, they get upset at the church. The church people get upset at us. And it's so heartening to be involved with the work. Like, it's honestly some of the most enjoyable work I've been able to do. So I'm on the left, so I'm really grateful for it.
And Katie, what does volunteering for New York for Abortion Rights look like on a Saturday morning?
Wow, yeah. So maybe not surprisingly, people who are going to church on Saturday or Sunday are up early. So we wake up early and head out. And I live in the community where the Brooklyn Witness for Life marches are happening. So it's actually been really, really, you know, intense for me to like connect with my community members, to see people who I see, you know, in my daily life around, but also, you know, wear a shirt that says abortion is freedom and let them know what is happening in our community. And that to know also that so many of them are pro-abortion, they might not, you know, they might say that they're pro-choice, they might not really have access to our kind of framework of how we think about this issue, and being able to bring that to a mostly wealthier white, you know, enclave of people, that is just really inspiring to me. And I think our goal is to sort of bring this to as many people as we can in New York City and let them know that there are people intentionally trying to stop abortions in New York and that we will not let that happen.
Yusuf, we're just chatting, you know, like, what could drive someone? It's so, like, for us, it's so hard. Let me say that number again before I collect my thoughts. 212-209-2877. 212-209-2877 to call us and talk about abortion access. You know, what could drive someone to travel across state lines and be in New York City at 8 in the morning to protest another person going into a health clinic to access an abortion. And, you know, I really try to come from a place of empathy. And, you know, I just think that maybe some of these people don't have control in their daily lives. Maybe they don't even have control over their own bodies. And because of capitalism, they don't have control over, you know, sometimes their finances, their health outcomes, their education, a million ways that capitalism oppresses all of us. And so maybe that lack of control drives them to want to control other people. But I don't know. That's just a thought. But I had one more question, Yusuf, about abortion access is often couched, even sometimes by the left, as a woman's issue. Is abortion access just a women's issue?
I wish I had an answer for your first question, but I don't really. I think you're right, though. Like, a lot of these people, when I speak to them, they often seem to have come from difficult backgrounds and rough upbringings and have had a lack of access to healthcare, and as a result have looked to the church, which provides some sort of solace for them. Not to say all churches, but, you know, for whatever reason, they're committed to this ideology, not only because of their beliefs, but also because of what the church can provide for them and the lack of support that they can get from outside of the church. And as far as abortion being a women's rights issue, I mean, sure, that's true. But it also affects trans people. It also affects, it primarily affects people of color. It's way more than, like, I don't know how we can consider ourselves to be in solidarity with other people if we aren't able to acknowledge that reproduction is an important feature in how society works. Like, if we take that issue seriously, then it means not just treating, like, all of these healthcare issues are all related and intersectional and have, but they're all tied together, and I think we need to be in solidarity with one another in order to, frankly, combat the right and people's desire to control people's autonomy and make decisions for others and provide a society that we can all flourish in and make decisions for ourselves.
And I'm quite disappointed, you know, in the right and the libertarians that are in support of this bill, because they claim that they want to be free from government interference and government control. And, you know, do you really think that, you know, just because it's, you know, abortion access today that is being, has a $10,000 bounty and anyone across the country can sue you for it, just because that's happening today, that it's, you know, that kind of government overreach wouldn't extend to other, you know, people and other groups and other, you know, issues. So, you know, come on. If you're going to have these opinions, then you need to be consistent. So, Katie, do you have anything else that you want to share on this issue? I know you've been organizing around this for a long time. Maybe a story or an experience that you've had organizing?
Yeah, I think following up on what Yusuf said about our tabling, I think it's just been incredibly inspiring, and a lot of people approached us. There was, you know, a woman who we shared that the people in Witness for Life pretend to be Planned Parenthood escorts. They wear pink vests to impersonate these escorts and try to deceive them into, you know, coercing them into, I guess, not receiving an abortion. And I know from very limited research on this that anti-abortion protesters in front of clinics is a source of distress for people receiving abortions. It is, you know, in their own words, sort of shown that it makes the experience more stressful. And this woman who we told this just started immediately crying, and sort of me and the other organizer I was with, we both started crying, and Yusuf and our other comrade Mike were there, and they were, you know, more in the action of handing out flyers, but it was a weird sort of collective sharing of just this sadness that people are being deceived in this way, and that the people doing the deceiving are doing so in the name of this moral higher power and think they have the high ground, but they don't. We do, and we know that. And we're not going to cede that high ground anytime soon, and we're going to fight until we have free abortion on demand.
And if our listeners want to help join the fight here in New York City with your organization, if you can give them some next steps, how to reach you via Twitter, Instagram, website, when your next action is.
Yeah, we're at we have a website at abortionrights.nyc where you can find us, and we're on all the things, but usually our handle is NYC for Abortion Rights, all spelled out. And yeah, we're going to be at the Women's March on October 2nd in Washington Square Park, so we're going to have a contingent there, along with some other left organizations, including the DSA and Left Voice and others. So yeah, looking forward to that. And then on October 9th, in Burham Hill, outside of St. Paul's Church, we're going to be having another action, as we usually do, to prevent these people from showing up to the clinic and the best we can. And we can use all the support we can get. So yeah, please come out.
Thank you so much, both of you, for talking about this, you know, very personal, very intense topic. And we really stand in solidarity here at Revolutions Per Minute with everyone's bodily autonomy, no matter where you are. So thank you both for coming on.
Thank you.
Thanks so much for having us.
And I hope to see you all on the streets October 2nd at the Women's March and October 9th at St. Paul's. So thank you again. You've been listening to Revolutions Per Minute on listener-sponsored WBAI in New York City, broadcasting at 99.5 FM and streaming on your favorite podcasting app. To connect with us after the show, you can email us at revolutionsnyc@gmail.com. You can also find us on our website, revolutionsperminute.simplecast.com, or on Twitter at NYCRPM. I'm Desiree Joy Frias. Good night, and abortion access for all on demand with no apologies.